I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Ilan Ziv, and we talk about his new film, An Eye for an Eye, which just recently opened in New York and coming to Toronto in the very near future. We talk about hate, and we talk about racism and forgiveness, and why the future may not necessarily be so bright, and why the media, in his mind, drives this dialogue and this conversation and this rhetoric about hate forward. We talk about why we don't really choose evil. It kind of, in a sense, almost chooses us. And Ilan talks a lot about mirrors, of distorted mirrors of our society, and that certainly comes up in this film. It's an unsettling film, and yet it's also incredibly positive. It's about Mark Stroman. He's the man who murdered several people after 9/11 many years ago, and ultimately was executed on death row. And it tells a story of revenge. It tells a story of forgiveness and relationship. And as Ilan says, this is a story about his friendship with Mark and what happens over a 10-year period. You need to see this film. And I'm hoping you feel that, like, you need to hear this conversation with Ilan and I. It's coming right up. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my speaking, podcasting, and writing. Real Change is Incremental is there for the taking. Rabble.ca for more interviews. And check them out as well online. Coming right up, Ilan Ziv, as we talk about his film, An Eye for an Eye. Well, welcome to Face. We are joined by a very special guest here today from New York City, Ilan Ziv. He's a documentarian filmmaker. He is, well, I think we're going to find out. He's quite a conversationalist as well and a very passionate guy. Ilan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Face to Face.
Thank you for inviting me.
So congratulations on the film. The film is An Eye for an Eye. A story of revenge, change, and forgiveness. Quite a film, Ilan. So many things to talk about, so many questions, so many themes and metaphors and opportunities. You know, the splash and ripple effect here, the potential for it is huge. Tell the audience, because they probably haven't seen the film. Film opens tomorrow in New York, opening in Toronto, and very soon in Quebec in the next day or so. Tell us a little bit about the story, your story, Mark, race, and so on.
Well, I heard about, I mean, it's a very long story how I got into it, but the short version of it is I heard about a story which never really made it nationally at the time, was about Texas' first hate crime after September 11. And it involved a guy by the name of Mark Stroman, whom the press described as a supremacist, racist, white. Some people said he belonged to the Aryan Brotherhood, who, as what he claimed was the revenge of September 11, went out and shot people whom he thought were from the Middle East, and ended up being immigrants from East Asia. He killed on September 17, September 15, he killed Wakir Hassan, a Pakistani man, in a convenience store at a gas station. On September 22, if I don't forget, he wounded a young man from Bangladesh, Rais Bahuyan. And then on October 7, he killed a Hindu, an immigrant from India, who... Vadoshev Patel. He was captured after that murder because he was caught on camera, but he was caught on camera as he was shooting Vadoshev, Mr. Patel. He was caught on camera saying, open the cash register, open the cash register. And on that basis, the prosecution asked for a death penalty because in Texas, it's supposed to be called capital murder. So they were not going to try him for the other murder and the wounding of Rais Bahuyan, but they were going to seek the death penalty for the so-called robbery, because capital murder is you commit a murder during another felony. And in their logic, the principal felony was robbery, which gone wrong, and he killed the guy during the robbery.
Ilan, it seems like such a crazy distinction, as you said, in their logic. Let's come back to that in a second. Tell me a little. So if an interviewer like myself says, Ilan, tell me what this movie is about, the logline is a story of revenge, change, and forgiveness. How do you kind of capture it, because it touches on so many
So the first part is the revenge, which means who is this guy and what physically he did and what he claims he did it. The story of change is him changing on death row over the 7 years that I accompanied him. And the story of forgiveness is because towards the end, 2 months before the execution, Rais Bahuyan, his only surviving victim, began a public and a legal campaign to try to spare Mark from the death chamber. So those are the three sort of headlines for the three part of the story. However, as you indicated, it has many more layers than that, because I always consider that story illustrative of, deeper and bigger issues. So it's not just the mechanism of revenge, change, because I do believe it symbolizes larger aspect of society. That's what I wanted to show.
Well, as you say, the bigger picture, bigger themes, greater story, the divisive kind of rhetoric that's going on politically right now with, the Trump campaign and the way the media is covering what's happening in the U.S. and us Canadians, of course, these things are going on here in Canada as well. They're going around the world. But it seems right now there's this, celebration of it in a way through the media. Does that make sense?
I wouldn't call it celebration, but the media showed it's not weaknesses, it's Achilles' heel. I mean, the media is ultimately looking for audience and rating, and that's what drives it. And if it could get rating by covering Trump 24/7, it will. If it get rating by covering Trump's sex life. So in that sense, I think it's wrong to think the media is, at least in my opinion, that the media is biased. The media is driven by rating, and it's driven by voracious appetite for rating, and that's really what drives it. So it will be against Trump if it pays. It will be for Trump if it pays.
Right.
It will be for against anything that brings audience. So, and again, when in the film, Tom Boston says the media drives hate. I do believe the media drives hate, but not because the media is made out of hateful people. Right. It drives hate because after September 11, hate brought audiences. So you could celebrate revenge of September 11 and the going to war in Afghanistan. If tomorrow something else will happen, the media will be against hate because the audience is disillusioned with hate. So what I'm saying is there's a dialectic with the audience, because the media is just listening to what he'd consider echoes in the population, and it plays on them and it magnifies them.
You say, Ilan, in the dialectics, you know, almost the dialectic of the conversation or of the hate-filled rhetoric. Do you in the film, you certainly lay out a story that suggests that Mark's past, his upbringing, the abuse, the emotional trauma, and so on that he suffered as a kid, as a young boy and a young man, and so on, played a huge role in the guy, in the man, in the person that he became. Do you, after having spent so much time with him and so intimately connected to this project, do you believe that hate is something we learn entirely, or is it that polarized?
I think with Mark, which that's sort of the only guy I can talk to right in depth. I think with Mark, it's two issues. I think Mark was taught hate. Mark was spanked, it's not in the film, but he was spanked when he played with a black friend. Mark was taught racism at home from a very young age. So Mark, in that sense, was taught hate. Mark was conditioned to hate because of the hateful environment that he grew up. You know, the lack of self-confidence, the abuse, the, you know, putting him down. His mother told him that she was a $25 short of an abortion, and that's the reason why he was born. Wow. So when you're born with that background, hate becomes the way you deal with the universe, because the universe is not a nice place. The universe is really hateful, and so it's a combination of Kordak was being taught hate and grew to hate. And I think when society doesn't intervene early enough and doesn't intervene forcefully enough, then the hate gets solidified and layers of layers. And when you're being thrown to at the age of 12 to kids' home, which in Texas is sort of a penitentiary for youth, and you get very little corrective treatment. You come out of it even more of a criminal, and then you commit another felony, like trying to rob, and you go to prison, and you come out of it a more hardened criminal. So I don't know if you've seen the series on HBO, The Night Of.
No, I haven't.
Which was about, I think it was played in Canada too. It's very captivating, and it's about a detective kind of serious, looking at a murder. But the mystery is this young Pakistani immigrant, the son of immigrants, he doesn't commit a murder, but there's no explanation for the body of the woman slashed. And he goes to Rikers Island waiting for his trial. And the film actually spent a lot of time in Rikers Island. And one of the gang leaders in the jail tell him, I like you, we're going to make you a good criminal. And at the end of the film, he's basically dismissed because the jury was hung, but he came out a criminal. He's already a cocaine and heroin addict. He saw way too much more than normal people should have seen. He was participating in violence in jail, and he comes out, potentially a future hardened criminal. So there's a lot to be said about that trajectory, that once you have that at home, you start committing small violation, you're being thrown to different level of penitentiary, you come out a hardened criminal. Mark was.
Ilan, it's surprising to me, the prosecutor that you show, who's clearly a man of faith, of a particular sort, and he says that, we choose evil.
We choose evil.
We choose evil. Is it as black and white as that for you?
No, I mean, I asked him that because he said it, and I'm very glad that I asked him, and I'm very glad that he replied, because I wanted to show, in my opinion, a profoundly erroneous way of looking at it, as if we are, which means the whole basis of that statement is that we are somehow rational human beings. We make choices every day, every hour. Some choices are good and some choices are bad, and we are punished. Now, in principle, yes. In reality, it's never the case, which means we are basically victims of a lot of things. We are victim of our psychology. We are victims of our past traumas. We are victims of education. We are victim of destroyed homes. We are victim of many, many things. So that does not necessarily justify crime or an excuse for crime, but it's a very simplistic way of looking at evil as if it's something that we choose. If you look at evil as something that I was conditioned to, or I was driven to, or I did, that may give you a whole different way of looking at how do I treat it. And again, it's not about the punishment, it's about how, because if you treat me as somebody who chose evil, then you should eliminate me, because it's a horrible thing to choose evil.
So in a sense, for you, I mean, this is my take, at least, for you, this isn't, I mean, obviously Mark is responsible, or Mark was responsible for the way he reacts, the way he behaves, etc. But in a sense, are you not saying with Eye for an Eye that, you know, we're all culpable, we're all in this together, we all play a role of one kind or another?
If we understand that Mark is a distorted mirror of our society, and in many ways he reflects his tormented mind at the time of the crime, our problems and our wrong attitude, then you get a much more holistic way to look at it. And if you look at it holistically, again, it's not about saying to Mark, okay, we understand, go home for free, because even in our deepest conversation over the 7 years, I always told Mark that I don't think he should get out of prison, which means you have to pay for what you've done. I don't think you should be executed, but I do think that you have to pay, because otherwise we cannot run a society,
right,
and you cannot justify it for the victim. So I always said that, Mark, you know, you should be, you know, in prison without parole, at least for the next 20 or 30 years, and maybe towards the end of your life, if you show that you've changed so much, maybe, you know, there's a room for parole, but not now. So everything I say is qualified by the fact that I don't think Mark should have been forgiven for what he did. He shouldn't be killed for what he did, but he shouldn't have been forgiven. He should have paid a punishment. However, if I was understanding the complexity of his crime and the complexity of his personality, maybe I could have a prison system that tried to address it. Not to lock him 23 hours a day and basically treat him like an animal and then get rid of him, like an animal, but a correctional facility which is trying to so-called correct while incarceration. Because there are many things that Mark was a very, very bright man. Mark could have finished high school and university in prison. Mark could have done a lot of things in prison. So if you look at Mark, but if he chose evil, according to the prosecutor, then he's an evil man. Evil men we try to get rid of. We don't like them in our society.
Ilan, at the beginning of the film, much like Werner Herzog, I couldn't help but be reminded of some of the narration in his films, and I so appreciated this about your film and how you inserted yourself into it in a very interesting and reflective and relational way. You know, you say, this is the story of our friendship. Did Mark become a better man, a different man, a richer man as a result of the friendship that he had with you, as a result of the questions you asked him, as the result of the intimacy that you guys developed together as friends?
I contribute to that. I will not claim first of all, Mark became a better man because he wanted to become a better man. So Mark had a self-awareness process.
Right.
So I don't believe anybody change anybody. I believe we contribute to each other via dialogue and interaction. So I did contribute to him. I came in the right moment in his life. And very soon, a few years later, I was surrounded by many other people who contributed too. So there was eventually a group of us who contributed to Mark and to be honest, we didn't even prod him. I never talked to Mark about changing. I never talked to Mark right. about the need to change. I never uttered the word change in any dialogue that we had over the 7 years. I don't think anybody else did. However, we provided two things. We provided a positive role model.
Right.
And we provided something which was very rare at the beginning for me even to acknowledge it. We provided support and love, and accepting his good and his bad, and accepting him as he was. And I think that was a huge impetus for him. And he even said it in the interview. So I think all of that contributed to him wanting to change. But he did the heavy lifting himself.
Did you ever see aspects of yourself in Mark, in a sense? And I guess the question I'm really asking you is, are we all in some way capable of this kind of hate, of this kind of behavior?
That was the opening premise for me to go and see him. The opening premise for me, I was in Israel in military service for 3.5 years. I participated in combat. I was in the October War for 3 weeks and then was mobilized for 6 months later. I participated in combat. So for me, killing and witnessing killing was not an alien thing. Again, you can say that, oh, but a war is a different thing. At the end of the day, on an individual basis, it's not that different, which means the war provides you a narrative that allows you to do things that you don't do when you take the metro in Toronto to work. So you do things that you're not normally supposed to do. You're punished for doing. But a war and a military give you a narrative to justify. Well, Mark created his own narrative, which was false and misleading. But he created the narrative that he wanted revenge, which was as good a narrative as the war is, beside the fact that society didn't accept it. And society doesn't accept those narratives. Society accepts for me a collective narrative. So if I move to Canada and I join the Canadian military and I send to Iraq and Afghanistan, society hails me as a hero and says to me, go and kick some ass, you know, and go and protect democracy by killing the bad guys. So it's a narrative. It's nothing more than a narrative.
So
it's societal accepted. Let me just say one more thing about this thing, if I may.
Yes, please.
Hear my rambling for another 20 seconds, but I'll get to the point.
That's good.
Because I know I told it false, for Mark, it's very important, and it was proven wrong, it was at the beginning, the impetus was, I kill, and people say, good, we need to kill those bastards. And it really happened with the murder of the Pakistani man, because the murder of the Pakistani man, I can tell you now, it didn't start because he was roaming around looking to kill Pakistani men. He was looking for trouble. He was boiling with hate, rage, whatever. And he was basically a ticking bomb waiting to explode. But the Pakistani man, which nobody knows that I'm giving you that little scoop, is the Pakistani man, basically he called in for two cheeseburgers, because he was working late, and he came into that, you know, little convenience store, and the cheeseburgers were not ready. And Mark exploded and shot the guy, after he forced him to come out of the plastic, the secure area, and cook him cheeseburger, and he shot him. So it started with cheeseburger, not about September 11. Now wait, then he goes to the bar, right? And the day after, and in the bar, all of his buddies, not knowing that Mark did anything, all of his buddies, redneck, you know, racist, white supremacist, whatever you want to call it, chilling in the bar, and they say, we got one. Did you hear? We got one. And this is where, you know, it clicks in his mind. Wow. So, like, I'm a good guy.
Right,
you know?
Right,
I'm doing it for a cause. I'm not just a lost guy exploding himself and creating this damage.
He says in the film that, you know, this was an act of war. I'm not a serial killer. This is an act of war.
Exactly. That's what the narrative that had to be destroyed through the 7 years, that he had to destroy and dismantle himself to see how false it was and how misleading it was. And by the way, in the last couple of years, he was not using it anymore because he realized how false the narrative. But at the beginning, that's what sustained the murders. I'm not doing it by myself. I'm doing it for a cause.
So, Ilan, tell me about the forgiveness. Tell me about you know, so many different levels of forgiveness going on in this film. I can't even begin to really chat about it in a substantive way. But tell us a little bit about Rais Bahayan, the Bangladeshi man who survived Mark's shooting, two shots, I believe, to that he survived. Who then goes on to not only forgive him, but to create a mandate for himself and for others about social change, about the death penalty, creates a campaign online. Tell us a little bit about that, that narrative. Well, I mean, and how does that narrative develop versus a one filled with hate?
That narrative developed, and Rais is the best to talk about it. That narrative developed because Rais were undergoing his own process too,
right,
in those years. So Mark is in prison, being visited initially by people like me, then by many others, getting pen pals from all over the world, and he's on a road to another phase. Meanwhile, you have Rais, who was thrown by this attack, suffered very badly, not only physically, he won a green card by a lottery that was lost because he couldn't go to Bangladesh to reclaim the green card. He is going for different eye operation and a treatment in Dallas. He can't work, so he's getting more and more into debt. He doesn't have any place to stay. He sleeps on friend's floor. Because he doesn't have any insurance, he end up owing dozens of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
of medical bills. So he's basically a bankrupt, and this is where I met him. So when I met him, he was in 2004, he was clawing out of that hole. He got a job, he succeeded to get some kind of a grant from a victim organization to get the debt of the hospital being taken care of. He started to work as a waiter in a restaurant in Olive Garden in Dallas, and he's working in the restaurant as a waiter, but he's working and he's making income, and he still cannot drive because he couldn't get a driving license because one eye was declared blind, and I think he semi-driving illegally by a car donated to him, because in Dallas it's very difficult to be without a car. So he's trying to get his medical thing so he can get a driver license officially. He's got a loan car. The dad is more or less taken care of, and he's making some kind of a living, and he wants to go to night school to study computer engineering, which when he told me that in 2004, it sounded like a fantasy.
Right.
Frankly. Totally a fantasy. But he does go to night school, and he does end up finishing, and he does get a job in computer engineering, and he actually makes a good living because he gets a job at a company that manage big websites like American Airlines and other airlines, and he's become a head of a team, and he runs around Europe because the team is in Europe and the Philippines.
It really is a remarkable story. I mean, near the end of the film, he talks about how, you know, this actually did sort of destroy his life, and yet it becomes apparently,
he rebuilt his life, and two things are important. He goes in 2009 to Mecca because he was always a devout man, and he goes to Mecca with his mom, which is kind of a very transformational experience because his family is in Bangladesh. You know, his mom is in Bangladesh. He takes his mom. He has enough money now to fly her and to stay in Saudi Arabia for a month through Holy Pilgrimage with his mom. He's now, you know, and he got his citizenship. So he's an American citizen. So suddenly he has the means, the spiritual commitment getting deepened, and he goes through these transformational experiences in Mecca. And then coming out of it is kind of a guy that says, now it's my time to pay back to my fortune, because I was starting from
nothing. Ilan, he said in the film, the quote is, after his visit and the time, and I guess this change that he went through, he said, my heart was softer than ever. What a beautiful way to lay it out.
So then he starts, out of these pure motives, he starts, what can he do? But by that time, you see, this is why it's so fascinating and why this film is, for me, was kind of unique, because I never, it doesn't happen in your life a few times like this, is because I wanted, so he disraises, now we, you know, the ping pong goes back to Mark. Now Mark is, I'm facing sort of, which is, we didn't talk about it, but okay, so now I lost my media credential because I promised Mark that I would be a witness to his execution. So I've been put on his friend list, a friend, which is a word that at those years, 2005, was kind of alarming. Why am I, who am I a friend of? Serial right, killer, right. You know? So I'm working through this. Why did I even agree to witness his execution? I'm trying to understand what is happening between me and Mark and this relationship. I'm kind of drawn into the guy more because I visited him on death row without a camera and we have a very frank conversation. So out of all of that, I come up with the ideas. Listen, I'm not going to finish the film before at least you're going to have an execution date. So, but I want to do something. So I come up with the idea of a blog. And the blog is getting more and more popular because, you know, a few hundred people and eventually at the end, a few thousand people are reading it on a weekly basis when he published it. Now, I did not know that one of the readers was Raiz. So Raiz gets sort of a window into Mark's changes. So when Raiz is ready a year later, in 2009, after reading Mark's blog and after going through his own process, he says, hey, why don't I try to save this guy because that's my interpretation of Islam. Did I forgive him? And therefore, and Raiz, by the way, is acting on a very, on stuff that we don't have in our Western penal system.
Right, right.
Because in the so-called barbaric, you know, state which support execution, like Iran, Saudi Arabia, etc., they might be barbaric on one side, but they're much more advanced than us on another because they have the capacity for the victim to forgive. And if the victim forgive, you don't execute the guy.
Right.
And so Raiz is kind of, I wouldn't say misplaced because it has a negative connotation, but it brings the concept from Islam into a Western legal system. Hey, I forgive. You can't kill him anymore because I forgive him.
You know, and so, Alain, I was just going to say, it truly is a remarkable film and a remarkable story in the sense of the layers that you pretty much put out there for all of us, not only to see, I guess, but our responsibility now. In some ways, I would like to think our obligation towards others, towards our culture, towards our community and globe and so on, is to get involved, is to have, you know, to ask some of these questions, to go a little deeper. And I'm not going to talk about it because I hope all of our listeners are going to see the film. But the way you end the film is just such a compelling statement about, I don't know, about hope, I guess. And you know, you talked about the narrative that we all develop and we all have our own. And you must be absolutely stunned as you've been making this film, watching things unfold in the U.S. with regard to the election, speaking of narratives and how poignant and timely your film really is.
No, but the interesting thing is that when Mark told me those lines, which are ending the film, which was 2011, it sounded like, for me, because I knew the intimacy of Mark and I knew what a profound statement for him to say that. So I was like a proud daddy that, wow, he really, really transformed and changed. So I was, but the poignancy of that statement was very global.
And yes.
I mean, don't forget it, before the Paris attack, before the attacks in America, because in America, you had only the Boston Marathon by then, I think, and you didn't have anything so before San Bernardino, before the candidacy of Donald Trump, before the rise of anti-Islam in an organized, so it didn't, it sounded like a great, wonderful statement from somebody that I'm so proud that he did it, but there was no threat of that kind of thing. Now there is a threat. So I didn't, to be honest, I understood the depth of the statement.
Right.
I didn't understand its potency. And now, when we live through these times all over the world, not only in the U.S., I see, wow. So it was so much more, it's so much more pointed now than it was for me in 2011. Because in 2011, we've had this big trauma of, you know, of September 11th, the attack, you know, invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan. We were beyond all of that, supposedly.
Supposedly, you know, yes.
Little that I knew, a little that I understood what I understand now. So Mark's statement, in that sense, was, for me now, is almost prophetic rather than just,
yes,
you know, a very meaningful statement. Because, boy, we got to be careful.
Ilan, sadly, we've got to wrap this up here in a minute. Maybe we can do a part two in the future. I would love to do that, and maybe even get Reis on the phone as well and talk more about his own story. But, you know, I mean, I think I know the answer to this question to some degree, but I would love to hear your comments, you know, about the future based on this story that you've developed, based on the lives that you've been able to shine this light into. And, you know, what kind of insights and wisdom? I mean, you clearly sound like a hopeful guy, and clearly I think the film is ultimately at the core incredibly hopeful. Where are we heading?
Well,
what do you think?
This was the wrong question to ask. And I'll explain to you very succinctly and shortly why. Because I'm doing a four-part series on the history of the war on terror, also for Canadian, I mean, Radio Canada, and for
nice.
In France. So I've been, the last couple of years, I've been delving in all these, interviewing high-level politicians and high-level security guys and all that. So the short answer is I'm very pessimistic. It's a hope, because as long as there's a human spirit and human capacity of change, there is hope. But we have to work very, very hard,
yes,
to change the pessimistic future that I see. So it starts by defeating Donald Trump, which is really just the first step. And it starts by not electing Marine Le Pen in France. And it started by trying to rectify the damage done by Brexit. And it started by millions of things. But there's a huge lifting to be done, because we're heading into very dark times, and I don't think we understand fully the danger that we are heading into. That's part of the series to show. So Mark is a hopeful message, and it's something that I cling, you know, personally a lot, because of this capacity of change and also the danger of stereotyping and how we should fight stereotyping. But we got to do a lot of fighting and a lot of work to convince a lot of people that, you know, eye for an eye, it's a dead end. And the other end, the other road, you know, whatever political configuration we find for it, it's the only hope for survival of us as society. Because eye for an eye leads to destruction. And Mark is a tiny symbol of the damage, the few lives that he destroyed, but we have the capacity to do it, a much bigger damage in a collective eye for an eye. Look at what we did in Iraq, and look what he did in Afghanistan, and look what, you know, so the potential, and look what we can do in our own societies, the damage that we can do in our own society. So the danger of eye for an eye, for me, has now become a huge danger, and the message of race and the message of victims who forgive is a very uplifting message.
It is.
But we got to really convince other people that it's not just naive and it's not just, you know, daydreaming, that it's very practical. Because eye for an eye will kill us all.
I think you've laid it out really well for everyone to see. It's a compelling story. I love the fact that there is hope there. That yes, it's a dark tale. It's difficult to watch at points, but I really appreciate it. And again, congratulations on, and you're opening tomorrow in New York, Toronto next week. We've been talking with Ilan Ziv. An Eye for an Eye is the film, a story of revenge, change, and forgiveness. Please do what you can to get out to see the film. Ilan, thank you so much time for your
thank you so much
for your time. And generosity today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mom Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.